I'm Trevor Cummings, and these are my thoughts on money.
Hello, and welcome to the Thoughts on Money podcast, what we like to call Tom. I am Trevor Cummings, your host of the podcast, and I am with our author of the Thoughts on Money blog today, Mr. James Andrews.
Hey, great to be here.
And my good friend and colleague, Mr. Sean Latimer.
Hello, hello.
So give me an example, Sean Latimer, of something that starts out good and just gets a whole lot better.
Oh, let's see. I don't know if this is the best example, but have you ever been recommended a restaurant and you go and your friends didn't tell you what they got, but they just said it was really good. And you pick out an appetizer and it's amazing. And then you pick out an entree and it was better. And then I'm normally not a dessert guy, but every now and then, if I'm like really feeling it, then you go with something like a butter cake or something that's really good. And you're like, wow, this was way better than I expected.
So James Andrews is that restaurant. Line dancing. Did you know our friend James was a swing dancer? So he's a swing dancer, a line dancer. I mean, every time I learn something about James, I just fall more in love with him. I'm like, this is amazing. Was it high school you were doing swing dancing?
Oh, yes. It was high school. So again, remember, I went by Jimmy back then, so
better.
Okay, I can't wait for dessert.
And dessert. So think of Jimmy, homeschooled Jimmy. So homeschooled my entire life. I love it, but there is a cliche, and the cliche is most often correct. So we would do swing dancing on like boardwalks, but like this is the embarrassing part, which is you have to like.
What do you mean, like on boardwalks?
So Long Beach is an example, right?
Like you
so
just like, go up and like if right when you step on a boardwalk, you're just like, I have to swing dance.
So like there are certain like how do I say this? Like outdoor music venues or outdoor malls where they have like a swing band. So there's certain bands that play like that genre of music, and folks who are like in the swing dancing like scene.
I don't know about swing dance. Is that like Zoot Suit?
It's like
Prohibition days.
Yeah, like spinning and I don't even know how to describe it. It's a lot of spinning and theatrics.
So wait, Sean asked the question that we were all talking, we didn't hear. Is this like flash mob?
Yeah.
You just show up and like a bunch of you start dancing on a boardwalk?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Not to that scale, but very similar. Like people just show up who know how to dance, who knew this band was going to be there and dance. And so the embarrassing part, just since we're learning things about me, that
there's one embarrassing part or there's multiple embarrassing parts.
It's only getting better.
My wife is going to love that I share this on a podcast. So Jimmy, again, we'll just say this is Jimmy, not James.
Like your alter ego.
This is my alter ego. I had a brown suede fedora that I would wear.
Oh, I like that.
My swing dancing hat. So Sean's like holding.
I'm keeping it together. Go on.
So it was like my hat. I would wear that as part of my outfit. Anyway, all that to say, I loved swing dancing because you learn block steps and certain moves. And then someone who doesn't really know rhythm, I could just piece moves together and like dance really well for a song. So to my credit, just since we're embarrassing me here, I could flip people. I could do pretty cool things because I learned the sequence of moves and it was a lot of fun. But
I like too that in the article you gave a nod to like a local dance place. You're like, hey, if you're in Orange County, come check out this place if you want to do line dancing.
That's true. So the ranch in Anaheim for line dancing is a great place to go check out.
As a fiduciary, he did not get paid to promote. No, but what I did love about your article, because I wouldn't have connected these dots naturally, is that you're saying like, hey, I don't have rhythm, but basically there's these little different micro steps and you have to put them together in a certain sequence. And if it's in a certain sequence, it works. So I don't know how to dance, but I have done the electric slide. And if you go the wrong way on the electric slide and you're in a group of people all doing it together, you are going to bump into somebody. So you basically then took that as an on-ramp to finance to say, you might know a few moves, but the sequence of those things together matters a lot. And what you took that to was this sequence of returns. Therefore, you can have the microphone back now. Go.
Yeah. And the more I thought about that analogy, there's actually a couple layers because the first layer is that.
Do any of these layers have your fedora?
Most of them. This is line dancing. This is James era, not Jimmy era.
Okay.
When did you become James?
After college.
Oh, okay. Got
this
it.
This is James era.
After we ate the world.
Coming of age, you know.
Jimmy.
When I'm watching people line dance, it looks easy because it's all the same moves in a pattern. And so from afar, it looks easy. Then you get in it and you enter the fray. And it's kind of hard because you're figuring out the motions, but then you figure out the motions and you feel like, oh, I could do this. And I felt like that also kind of applied to people who watch investors. Watching from afar, the good decisions usually look easy, the bad decisions look obvious. Then you're in the fray and you realize, oh, this is harder, but I can figure this out. And then it was when I was line dancing, I was like, not only do I need to know the moves, I need to know the sequence, because I would constantly find myself in a position I didn't want to be in, right? Way on the other side of the floor.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, I live in the Christian community. So many people, I won't say his name, but it rhymes with Dave Ramsey, and they listen to him and they're like, oh, it's just easy. I just buy some mutual funds and I get a 12% return. And then I just kind of wait it out. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds amazing. I wish it was that easy. Yeah. But from afar, we all think we could throw a 60-yard touchdown.
Well, that's easy. But one thing I like that you said, that the mistakes, they look obvious. Like, oh, of course I wouldn't do that. I can't believe they did this. But when you find yourself in that moment, it's pretty easy to make mistakes.
Exactly. Exactly. So pulling this through to investing, and really what I was thinking about for this article was retirement and retirement funds, right? So you enter into retirement, you want to know, I want to earn, again, the percentage doesn't really matter, but for the sake of this article, I chose 7% annual return, right? On average, I want to make that much money every year. We know every year is different and there's always ups and downs, but if that's your average, that's the goal, right? That's like entering into the line dance, knowing these are the moves I have to make. What I don't know when I get the line dance is what sequence of moves I do to make that dance happen, right? In the same way with investing, if I need to get 7% in the example of this article, how do I get there? Is it with a few really good up years and then a lot of just small down years, or how do I put those pieces together? And the word I use in the article is the word sequence, right? A sequence of events, which is defined as a process of just putting events or actions in a certain order, right? Your performance for year one was X, your performance for year two was Y. And going across 25 years, when you put those together, what's the net result? Does that make sense so far? And just in terms of playing the land?
If our listeners go to the actual graphic used in the article, you basically give three example investors. Yeah. One of them gets a 7% return every year, just a fixed return every single year. The next one gets a mix of different returns, starts out with some down years, and then it kind of mixes. But on average, if you put it in Excel, it still averages 7%. Mm-hmm. And then the third one, I think it's just a flip. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just the inverse of whatever many years, 25 years of returns. It's just taking that random sequence that averaged 7 and flipping them. And it's basically saying, if you're accumulating wealth, it actually doesn't matter the sequence you get it in, right? You could start with some down years and then have some good years, and then you could do the inverse of that. An average of 7 is all the same in the accumulation phase, but everything changes in the distribution phase.
And another thing to keep in mind too is when you're looking at compounding percentages, I think sometimes insurance companies are really good at marketing this, where they'll guarantee a certain percentage. And you might think, like, let's say you do run a financial plan and someone determines that you only need to compound at 5% to meet your financial goals. And then you see a commercial and it's some sort of investment product that guarantees 5% each year. I think it's really important to understand that not all of the returns are calculated the same way. Sometimes they're what's called simple interest based off the original amount. I'm kind of getting in the weeds, but I think it's important to know that compounding a growing number over time is very different than taking an original investment and getting a percentage on that number for the rest of your life. They're very different things.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance. Like even maybe that product is compounding the growth of a withdrawal base, but it's not like your walk away money. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that nuance matters when you build a financial plan. You say, I just have to do this. And, you know, XYZ says it can do this. Therefore, wash my hands. I'm done. I'm good.
Yeah. This isn't related to the article, but it's related to this comment. I'm just curious on you guys and your feedback on this, because I had a conversation with a few folks recently about this. So the link is to bond funds specifically. So interest rates are higher. So the yields that bonds pay now are higher than they were in the past. And so individuals have shared that, why don't I just buy bonds? I'll get the interest payments every year. I'll cash those out and then I'll just recycle to new bonds and just get my percentage return that way, as opposed to being in the stock market and having all the volatility. And it always depends on the bond funds. But in my mind, that's kind of a comparison of simple versus compound, because inflation is compounding 2% on a higher number and a higher number. But a bond fund, even though it might be less risk, if you're spending that 5% and not reinvesting it, you have, it's actually simple interest based on the principal. Is that, I mean, that seems similar to what we're talking about here. Have you guys seen that as well with conversations?
Yeah, I think you're defining it right. The financial term is reinvestment risk, yeah. Right? So if you go buy a 10-year treasury right now, I don't know what rates are, 4.65% or whatever. Yeah, that could be attractive today, but what happens when that thing matures and you have to reinvest it? The other thing is, what do we do at the Bonsa Group? Dividend growth. So the big focus is growing income each year because your expenses are growing. And that's what you're talking about, is that when you get that 4.65% from a 10-year treasury, you either are going to spend it or you're going to reinvest it. Reinvestment risk is you don't know what that new interest rate's going to be. So if you operate under an assumption that interest rates today are higher than they will be 2 or 3 years from now, then that is going to create trouble for you.
That makes sense.
So it's a little bit of kicking the can. You're deferring an issue. The other thing, we won't get into it, we'll get back to your article, is there's this idea of opportunity cost. Even if you think you're okay with 4.65%.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh, go ahead.
No, just that you have to factor in the total return, and you might think like, well, this is going to be less volatile and at least I'm getting pretty close. Well, a difference of 2 or 3 percentage points over a long period of time, it can be a big difference.
Yeah. And I don't know year to date what the stock market's up. It's probably in the range of 10%. Is that fair? I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but let's say it's up 10% on the year. And let's say the bond fund's flat. That psychological part on the opportunity cost and the fact that you're not diversified is going to cause issues as much as you think you're going to stick with this plan that you had.
That makes sense. Makes sense.
But the big part of your article was that, and I just love the analogy, is that if you know a few line dancing steps, but you don't put them in the right sequence, you are going to be bumping into your partner. And what we see here is that the sequence of returns for accumulating wealth, they don't actually matter. Right? You could get a 0% return every year, and on the very last year, get this monstrous return. If over 25 years, average 7%, you're in the same place, right? Very different.
I think a lot of people are banking on that, actually. You know, they're like, I'm just going to save a lot and have a really good return year right before retirement.
Yeah, exactly. But when you get to distributing, the reason the math changes is because you're now having to take money out. Yeah. And if I have $100, and unfortunately, in the very first year, sequence of returns risk, in the very first year, my $100 is down 20%. I now have $80. If I wanted to withdraw 4%, my $4 I'm going to withdraw from 80 is more than 4% because that base number is changing. And the nice thing about what you did is in this graphic that you provided, I think it's the same returns over the same 25-year period, but it shows that since the sequencing is different in the distribution phase, one of our fictitious investors ran out of money. One of them had less money when they passed away than when they started. And then the third one ended up with about the same amount of money. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's intuitive if we went on the streets of Newport Beach and said, hey, if returns are equal for three investors on average for 25 years in accumulation, does it end the same? Yes. What about in distribution? They probably assume yes, but it's drastically different. So it should draw attention to the listeners of this podcast or the readers of this article to say, huh, would this impact me?
Exactly. And so there's two things I want to add to that just as we flesh this out. So the first is that I hear often, and I've read this often too, which is that rule of thumb of the 4% rule, meaning I want to target about 4% pulling out of my portfolio. This gives me a nice starting point for understanding if I have enough. And it's a great starting point to back into. But what's helpful with this article and really the math is that if you just rely on that rule of thumb for retirement and you get the sequence wrong, even if it's no fault of your own, you can still find yourself in trouble 20 years down the road when you can't go back to work again. So it's one of those things where you really want to make sure your bases are covered and you stress test for this. What I like to link over to this article, there's two financial terms or concepts that are used often. It's called risk and volatility. These are often used in conjunction with each other, often in the same sentence, but they mean
often synonymous.
Yes.
Even though they're not.
Okay. Even though they're not. And so actually like Sean, because Sean on a few times.
I actually like Sean too.
I like him too. Sean mentions this a lot, which is how he defines risk and how he looks at risk and how he looks at volatility. So Sean, since you bring it up often, actually, I think it'd be helpful to hear how you think about risk and volatility and how those might be a little different from each other.
Yeah, I think that risk is the chance of permanent loss of capital. So you invest in something, and if you determine it risky, can the money disappear? Or essentially, can the loan default? Can the business not exist? That's how I would define risk. Volatility, I think, is to be expected. The price per share of a stock, or the value of a rental property, or the actual value going up and down is common and should be expected. I think those are two very different things.
Yeah. But in your experience, do you think volatility drives risk in terms of volatility would drive investor behavior to make decisions where permanent loss or gain of capital? Do you see those two as being linked?
Oh, okay.
Or do you think those as fully independent?
But see, that's different. When I say like risk, I'm defining the risk of an investment itself, sure, of the permanent loss of capital, not the behavior of the client making bad decisions and resulting in permanent loss of capital. Mm-hmm. But you nailed it on the head. There's a behavioral risk of clients that if they get spooked in March of 2020 and they call you and say, hey, I want to make some changes, and you say, actually, no, I don't think that's a good idea. And they're like, well, Jimmy, what do you know? I'm going to sell everything. And then 6 months later, they go, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That is correct. So that is a permanent loss of capital, but for a different reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Risk is a funny word too, because it kind of loses its potency because it means so many different things to different people. Like, let's get outside of finance. And, Sean and I have a couple of friends that we play basketball with that have gotten hurt recently. So we're saying like, oh, basketball's kind of risky, right? But somebody else is like, I'm going to climb Half Dome with like no ropes. Like,
yeah,
it's pretty risky.
I'm a free climate.
Yeah, exactly. Free solo. Like, that's not even in the same like universe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's so hard to use the word risk and for the person using the word and the person receiving the word to understand it exactly the same.
No, exactly right. So how does risk, volatility, and the sequence line up? So you retire and you're now invested for the long haul, 25 or so years, but you're now pulling money from the portfolio, right? So now the risk has entered the equation because now you are forced to sell at certain market points. They may be high, they may be low.
And let me do my math real quick, because I think it'll help the listeners a little bit. At $100, it goes down. I was going to take out $4, right? Mm-hmm. My $100 is now $80. That same $4 withdrawal, which I thought was 4%, is now 5%. And that's what you're kind of getting at, is as the portfolio goes down, that assumed withdrawal, because you're not going to change your withdrawal.
Yeah.
You don't want to withdraw 4% of whatever the number is because you have bills to pay.
Yeah.
And the issue there, and then I'll give it right back to you, is that you go study a year like 2000, 2001, 2002, of three really, really rough years. It compounds negatively, and you find yourself starting to withdraw 7% or 8% based on that base number you were going to use. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the sequence, you've taken out capital, the volatility, the risk of the market going up or going down, and then leads to the risk of having less than you thought you would have expected to have entering those first few years of retirement, right? So that's how they link together. And so what's helpful to know is, when you're building a retirement plan, when you're thinking about retirement, not only do you need to understand what the target performance you need is, but also thinking about the plan in place at what, how will you withdraw those funds? Because if you just construct your portfolio to say, look, let's just go on the far side of the spectrum and have cash under the pillow, that solves the volatility and the risk, but it hurts for future returns. And then vice versa, if you go all the way to highly volatile assets, if you have to sell at low points, then you're really in trouble for when the market maybe has a downturn. And so the question is, what does an investor do? Like, how do you line dance with retirement funds, and how do you think about that? And so we have, I listed a few different ways that we work with clients. Monte Carlo's a common one, cash flow, and then safety buffers. Trevor, when you think about Monte Carlo simulations, what does that look like? Can you define that? And how do you use that for client situations?
Bad person to ask. I hate the Monte Carlo.
Okay. Why?
Because I think we build portfolios that depend so much on producing income that is both sustainable and growing.
Yeah.
And I think when you're doing a Monte Carlo, it's actually not looking at the variation of where the return comes from, whether it's income or appreciation. It's looking at it as like a bundled lump sum.
Yeah.
So I don't, it's not like I said I hate it, but maybe I should take that back. But like, what it actually produces. So I would say for most of our clients, I'm just using a general number, we can run these financial plans, and the Monte Carlo is basically going to say that I don't know, 90% of the time, they don't outlive their nest egg.
What a good plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And what it's literally saying is it ran 1,000 scenarios, and in 900 of them, they were fine. But in 100 of them, those sequences mm-hmm. weren't ideal. And based on their longevity and their expenses and inflation, they actually ran out of money. So I think it's hard for clients palette that, and a 10% failure rate is a pretty high failure rate.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the other thing I'll add to it, and then you can argue against me, but the other thing I'll add to it is, sorry to our whole planning team that uses Monte Carlos every day. Clients, you should listen to them. No, but the other thing I'll add there too is that in reality, Sean and I talk about this a fair amount, is that if things started to go awry, people would pivot. And most of the time in Monte Carlo is looked at in like a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. Like if your spending was always this, but you would tighten the belt, you would make adjustments, and you would pivot as life threw you curveballs. But go ahead, you can take the other side of the argument.
No, I'm curious with this one, because I actually had a discussion not too long ago with our head planner, Joe, about Monte Carlo for clients. Because I think I am agreeing with you with TBG clients, where so much of the retirement income is from growing dividends, a lot more stable. In prior jobs or in prior companies where the portfolios were more just diversified assets, right? It was just ETFs or indexes, not necessarily income production. I saw those as more sensitive to value fluctuation, and therefore I relied on Monte Carlo more to understand how strong those portfolios were to market swings.
I think that's fair.
Think it's fair?
Yeah. The only thing that always made me uncomfortable, like if you went to the producers of these software, right, like a Money Guide Pro or an eMoney, and you basically said, hey, for a client, and maybe I'm phrasing this wrong, so maybe somebody will email me and correct me, but if you went and you said, hey, like when we're running these plans and stuff like that, you know, your organization's run hundreds of thousands of these plans, what are we trying to get to as far as Monte Carlo? I think most of them are going to say like 85%. And that's the only thing that confuses me is like, so the client really has to believe that there's literally a 15% chance that they're going to fail. And that just seems odd to me. So for me, my biggest complaint is I like to see myself as a translator. So I like to translate what a Monte Carlo means to a client, I think is a little bit murky. And I think our industry loves to do them. I don't know if our clients always digest and understand what it literally means.
I'm going to go on the other side. I like them. I think that you wrote an article about this a long time ago, but it brings awareness to the clients of where they stand now. And I don't think it's ever going to say 100%, because it's almost like a disclaimer that we don't know what the future could hold, right? So
that's a good point. It probably never says 100.
It would never.
It does.
Or it shouldn't, right? Because at some black swan event, like, I don't know, if we see an asteroid coming and it's going to be the end of the world, someone's like, nah, my Monte Carlo is 100%. I'm good. Like,
for that.
I think that at the end of the day, it is an educated guess. But that awareness and the adjustments that you make along the way really do matter. I like what you said. There should be a button like where if there is a recession or some sort of pullback or correction more than 20%, that you actually have 10% of the income reinvest instead of being pulled out or whatever it is. Because I do think clients would pivot if they had a big trip planned to Europe and it's like it feels like the end of the world and their portfolio is down 20 or 30%. Maybe they postpone the trip till next year. I don't know.
I changed my mind. I agree with Sean. I think it's helpful. The only thing I'll add is I think our industry makes it the most important thing.
Yeah.
And I think like Sean's saying, awareness, directional, part of the process, it's good. It's hard for me because most of the clients I'm working with are not in the realm of worried about running out of money. Mm-hmm. They're more in the realm of how do we create a legacy with this wealth. So,
and I think you said perfect, like it's not designed the right way for our type of investment portfolio. Because we have a handful of clients that they may not plan on touching the principal, and they plan on spending the income, and so a lot of times it's not going to pencil out the same.
Mm-hmm. And it does change. I like it because it shows sensitivity. So if you run a financial plan and the Monte Carlo says 90 or whatever the percentage, and then you increase spending by $2,000 a month, something maybe nominal.
That's a good point.
But it goes from 85 to 60. That's just helpful guardrails to know. Okay, we are on track, assuming all things are equal, but any micro change in lifestyle or performance, we're going to have to course correct sooner rather than later. So I agree with you. It's not an end all be all. I like it.
One more complaint.
You go for it.
It's a little bit of a sausage factory. So if you're not granular and you're not looking at what returns it assumes, inflation, stuff like that, it can make you overconfident,
yeah,
right? Because if you use some of the default rates of return in these systems that are based on the last 100 years, then it produces some number. You're like, oh, whew, sweat off my brow. This is awesome. It's going to work out. And like, yeah, but it did assume a 9.2% rate of return. You know what I mean? So I think rather than just kind of hitting the go button and a number being produced, you have to be pretty granular, the right word, whatever. Like I said, yeah, you have to look at all the numbers and make sure that they're realistic. So there's just a lot of inputs.
There's a lot of inputs. And I mean, you say this often, which is financial planning is more of an art than a science, mm-hmm, right? So we like to put numbers on things and calculate, but it's art. It's understanding how we bring all these inputs together, which is helpful thinking when we think about the point that I make on this article, which is that Monte Carlo is one area that we look at for retirement line dancing. But the second one is cash flow is king. We talked about this a lot already, but just to give a brief review, we really believe strongly here at the company, at the Bonds Group, about dividend growth, right? Owning equities that pay profits to shareholders, and you over time have a larger portion of those profits. And when that is your base for retirement income, you're less susceptible to depending on market swings. And so they still matter. We still account for them. But the level of, or the degree of dependence you have on them is less. So that's why we like it. It's also why clients who have retirement, who have rental properties, where cash flows are fairly consistent, those Monte Carlos look so good because it's detached from the variety of the stock market returns. So I don't know if you guys want to add to that one before we go to the third.
No, I mean, I think a funny thing about that is sometimes when people see, you know, like maybe they don't have a lot of experience in finance or investing or whatever, and they say, oh, okay, like this is a logical claim right here. Like, Sean, you've walked me through this. I get it. I'm at the phase of retirement. You built some investments that are a little bit more income centric. So in my equity portfolio, I'm giving something up, right? I'm not going to get growth because instead I'm getting income. And I think that is false. I think you can study history and you see how dividend stocks have performed. And it sounds too good to be true if you leave it at just a statement, but I do believe you can get both. Have you run into that before?
Absolutely. No, I think the total return can be similar. And it does depend on the time frame measured. You know, of course, you're going to find years where maybe it's like that constant argument of growth versus value, where certain time frames, one's better than the other. But if you look at the compounding effect of a growing dividend into more shares during good times and bad times, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And what I think where I landed as somebody whose background was or is a certified financial planner is that from a planning perspective, building an income-centric portfolio that is made up of sustainable and growing income makes it a lot easier as a planner. And it makes a lot easier of a conversation of saying where they're literally going to get their paycheck from, rather than, it's not fingers crossed, but rather than hopefully the markets are friendly. And if the markets are friendly, then you will get a paycheck. It would be like working for a business where you're like waiting for, you know, customer payments to come in with your fingers crossed. I hope I can pay all the employees today. It's like, that is not good. It's just why I'm with you. I sit in the cash flows king camp.
It's one of the reasons why I came here was I saw this at my old employer a lot. We had 80-year-old clients.
Who did we hire? Did we hire Jimmy or James?
This is a little bit about.
Okay.
I think I wanted Jimmy.
Jimmy's fun.
Jim.
I love that. I love that part of the portfolios. That's what drew me here. All right, last one, safety buffers. So I think of your retirement, or like the portfolio is like your castle. You want to protect the portfolio. You want to preserve it. You want to grow your kingdom. And so to protect it, we think about lines of defense, right? You have a gate, you have a moat, you got guards, you got whatever.
Is that the name of your dance group?
Lines
at the ranch?
Oh my goodness, I can't get over that. I just completely lost my train of thought.
Sorry, go on.
No, you're good. So lines of defense for portfolios. One of the things we look at first is cash, right? Having cash on hand in money markets or treasuries. Rule of thumb for us, everyone is unique, about 3 to 6 months, right? This is helpful so that if you have a roof leak or your pool breaks, or you need to write large checks quickly, you're not selling at a time when maybe the market isn't favorable for you to sell. Second layer defense would be we have a few years in usually bonds of some sort for the clients as well. So again, you can write larger checks, or if, like Trevor mentioned, we have years of 2001, 2, and 3 where the markets are lower for longer, you can draw from the bond portfolio and preserve the equities to grow over time. Again, helping with that sequence of events. And then from there, right, that third line of defense are dividend producing or income producing assets. And then the mixture between that and appreciation focus always depends with each client. But putting those three lines together gives you plenty of cash that's working for you, gives you plenty of income, and helps buffer if you just happen to retire in 2024 and we just happen to have three more years of down markets. Or we don't know what that holds, but we also don't want to postpone retirement if we feel confident the assets are there. So that's how we think about things, so that when we think you are ready, we have lines of defense, even if the market turns and we have unfavorable moves. Any more thoughts on that?
Yeah, one thing to add is that the reason why we do 2 to 3 years of expenses is a lot of times when you try to look up an allocation of, or if you Googled, you know, how much in bonds should I have in my portfolio, it may spit out a percentage of the overall portfolio. And after measuring clients' financial plans and their balance sheet, we'll find that 2 to 3 years is probably sufficient. And most of the time we'll find it's a much lower percentage than what you would expect, which ultimately provides possibly a greater total return for the portfolio over time. But I think that's something really important to notice. You might read that quickly and think, oh, 2 to 3 years, I have a 60-40 portfolio, perfect. But if you really dig into what your actual expenses are through retirement, that 2 to 3 year number may be a much lower percentage.
And it's been crucial over the last 2 or 3 years where bonds are probably close to the same price today that they were 4 years ago, mm-hmm. Because of where interest rates went. I don't know the exact timing, but you know, somewhere in that range. So I think it also applies, we're really focused on people that are retiring, but I think that same concept applies to young people. My conversation with, you know, 30-somethings that are beginning to build out a financial plan, I will ask them, what is the most important thing in your financial plan today? It's not the balance sheet, it's you and your ability to earn wages. So therefore, let's put lines of defense, right? So I would say that there's 3 things that could happen to your wages. You could lose your job, you could lose your abilities, you become disabled, or you could lose your life. And all 3 of those things would have a huge impact on your family. So therefore, build a plan for each. Emergency fund to solve for a job loss where you need some time before you find another job. Life insurance to basically give a lump sum death benefit that could create a replacement income for your family. Or disability insurance to literally get an income from insurance that would replace your income. So that idea of safety buffers and lines of defense, it's just wisdom. Yep. Right. And my brain always goes to kind of the same place. If you were an architect and you're building a building, you would have multiple fire exits because you don't know where the fire could be. Right. If for some crazy reason you decided you wanted to do the trapeze, if it's your first time doing it, you're going to have a net below you. Right. Because there's a huge risk. So I would say for financial planning, this idea of safety buffers, you should plan for the obvious risks. Like Sean said, black swan, stuff like that, curveballs of life, a lot of things could happen. But the obvious things that you could lose your job, that our lives are fragile, you could lose your life or your abilities through disability, those things should just be planned for.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I really like all of those so much because I often think about retirees and I forget that it's just as common for folks who are still building the wealth, right? There's still lines of defense you need to have. The hope with this article is that hopefully it shows that while retirement planning isn't overly complicated, there is work and analysis that is helpful, because just kind of winging it, right, just jumping onto the dance floor and seeing how far you can get before you make a stumble, you may find yourself in a position where you just can't earn out of the loss, right? That happens more often than I would like it to happen with a lot of folks that I encounter. And so just understanding... There is Uncle Todd.
Uncle Todd. You remember Uncle Todd? Yeah. Sorry, listeners.
We'll never forget
Uncle Todd. Past podcasts. Hopefully you listen to it. Yeah.
But just understanding that, right? We're always here to help, but there's a lot of tools out there. But just one thing to keep in mind as you plan for retirement.
Favorite part about this article?
Jimmy and the fedora.
Yeah, but that wasn't in the article. Just love that you ended it. Happy dancing.
Happy dance.
So how often would we be able to find you and your wife at the ranch?
Not often. I'm a dancer. She's not as much into dancing.
Oh, okay.
So it's more of a Jimmy thing. It's when I can really let my Jimmy flag fly.
On that note, thank you for listening to the podcast. Please review the podcast. Give it 5 stars. That'd be so kind of you, even though James might not have totally pleased you today with our podcast, but we will ask that 5 stars. You can email any of us, Sean, Jimmy, or James, or Trevor. You can reach us at tom@thebonsagroup.com. Happy to answer your questions. Great article today. This idea of sequence of returns risk is a thing that is not intuitive, not obvious, but something that can impact most people that we talk to. So knowing it, understanding it, and to protect against it is wisdom. So with that said, we will be back next week with more of our Thoughts on Money.
The Bonson Group is registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC, and with Hightower Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor with the SEC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. This is not an offer to buy or sell securities. No investment process is free of risk, and there is no guarantee that the investment process or the investment opportunities referenced herein will be profitable. Past performance is not indicative of current or future performance and is not a guarantee. The investment opportunities referenced herein may not be suitable for all investors. All data and information referenced herein are from sources believed to be reliable. Any opinions, news, research, analysis, prices, or other information contained in this research is provided as general market commentary. It does not constitute investment advice. The team and Hightower shall not in any way be liable for claims and make no expressed or implied representations or warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the data and other information, or for statements or errors contained in or omissions from the obtained data and information referenced herein. The data and information are provided as of the date referenced. Such data and information are subject to change without notice. This podcast was created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the team and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Hightower Advisors do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented to any entity as tax advice or tax information. Tax laws vary based on the client's individual circumstances and can change at any time without notice. Clients are urged to consult their tax or legal advisor before establishing a retirement plan.